Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
The Harvest by Julie Carpenter, with music by the author. Read by Scott Rosenberg, Jason Amos, Dane Luscombe, and Julie Carpenter.
Welcome, everybody. I'm your host, Daniel Greengold, and this is the Fragments Podcast, bringing you stories from the far-flung corners of these disunited states. Today's story takes us to the Republic of Texas and into the kitchens of the New Prosperity Church, the guts of a mouse, and the ruins of Houston. Now, for my listeners who may not follow post-secession Texas politics, some background on New Prosperity Church. Its roots stretch back to the 1980s with televangelists like Jim and Tammy Faye and Pat Robertson. They were a gaudy joke, but over the years, this hybrid of capitalism and fundamentalist religion built powerful churches that presided over the purses of ever more powerful politicians. The megachurches bought land, businesses, schools, and ran them tax-exempt. When Texas left the Union, New Prosperity found itself in charge of the entire Texas university system. We'll come back to that moment with a later guest, but first, let's meet 15-year-old Daisy. Daisy was 12, and her sister Hannah just 6, when they found themselves lining up for food and shelter at a New Prosperity charity called Little Angels in the Houston downtown ruins. Hi, Daisy. Thank you so much for talking to us today. Are you doing okay?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Daisy, could you tell us how you and Hannah ended up on the streets? You weren't like a lot of the other kids, right?
Yeah, right. Most of the other kids had been dumped there or had run away. We had a family. Mom was a doctor. Dad was a reporter. They were helping people get out before the secession, but they waited too long to get us all out. I had an old thing called a pager, a little black brick. If it buzzed, I was supposed to grab Hannah, take a cab downtown, and then walk to a secret apartment to wait for our parents, but they never came back. We lived on the stored supplies there for about 6 months, just hiding. I had to make up games to keep Hannah busy. She was bouncing off the walls. I read a lot. There was nothing else to do. Then one night, someone set the whole block on fire and we had to come out. We ended up under an overpass where lots of the homeless kids camp.
Is that where you heard about the shelter?
Uh-huh. Hannah got really sick a few days after we got there. And this older boy who kind of ran the camp told us about the Little Angel centers, where maybe they would help us. He said we'd need to pretend we couldn't read if we wanted to get picked up and taken away to a New Prosperity neighborhood. Hannah would need to look healthy, at least until they took us. He said we should try, because we didn't know how to live on our own like the others.
What happened when you got to the shelter?
They fed us, and then a nurse talked to each kid. I told them our parents dumped us. She smiled and said, "We'll see whom the Lord chooses." I didn't like that. Our parents had taught us to be careful around church people. Church people were government people, and I knew I couldn't let them find out who we really were. But Hannah was just so sick, hugging her little brown bear. She was too tired to even be trouble. There were about 40 kids there, and they only had 18 places on the bus to New Prosperity. I decided to help the Lord choose and checked off our names on the list when the nurse wasn't looking. Well, they weren't really our names, just the ones I'd given them. I hoped Hannah could remember.
How did things go when you reached the new Prosperity neighborhood?
It felt like forever we drove out of the city and into the trees. It was getting dark by the time we passed through the big gates of New Prosperity Woods. There were only girls on our bus, no boys. They took us to a little white chapel with a fireplace where they made us take off our clothes and burn them because of germs and fleas. They made Hannah burn her bear. I hated them so much right then, but I swallowed it because I couldn't risk losing her. She was too weak to cry. I thought of the muddy little graveyard the kids under the bridge had made. They let us take showers and gave us white dresses to wear. I made her stand up straight next to me and try to look healthy so they wouldn't separate us. A bony old woman called Mrs. Mary took over and told us the rules. She said, and I will never forget this, "Tonight you have the great privilege of waiting at the Lord's table. You will bring out the plates and place them neatly in front of those seated, and when they are done, you will take them away. This food belongs to the Lord and his people, and if you steal, he will strike you dead. You may not touch so much as a crumb, not even after. You will be rewarded if you obey." Her lips were so red, I felt sick. I thought, okay, if we get through this, get some sleep. When Hannah's better, we'll run away.
I know this next part is very difficult for you. Are you all right? Can you tell us what happened at dinner?
I'll be okay. They took us all to a big dining room at the main church building. About 20 rich-looking couples sat around a long table. Mrs. Mary walked us down the line and thanked the man in the white suit at the end of the table for his generosity in letting these little angels serve him. Ugh. We followed her into the kitchen to begin our work. We carried in massive plates, big bleeding steaks for the men, and grilled chicken for the women. I saw baskets of rolls, potatoes, bright red tomatoes on cold green salads, beautiful lemon yellow butter. Most of the kids had never ever seen food like that, and I hadn't since I was little. The smell made me dizzy. I glanced at Hannah. Her jaw was clenched, her eyes were so far away. I wanted to take her hand, but I was afraid it might be against the rules. As they finished, we began clearing plates and I began to relax a little when I heard a plate shatter. I turned, saw Hannah lying on the floor in the shards with a bit of bread in one hand, a shell, lifeless. I heard someone sobbing, but no one moved. I tried to go to her, but Mrs. Mary gripped my shoulders and said, "We do not mourn thieves." They took us all away through the kitchen. I didn't see what they did with her.
I'm so sorry, Daisy. I can't imagine what that must have been like for you. How long after that did you escape from New Prosperity?
It took me about 2 weeks to figure out the routine and the layout of the neighborhood well enough to try it. They were watching me closely for a few days. One night, the nurse came to my bed and pressed a little braid of hair into my hand. It's all that I have of my sister. Some of us were assigned a family to work for, while others, like me, served the homeowners association at the main church building. No kid ever tried to take anything again while I was there, after Hannah. I think they really bought it, that God was watching them.
But you didn't.
No. First of all, people do worse things all the time and no one strikes them down. She was just a hungry kid. But there was more. I can read, and I saw something in the kitchen where I was working. I brought it with me when I escaped, hiding in the garbage truck until it took me out of the gates. I had to get it out of Texas and bring it to someone who could tell me what it meant.
After the break, we'll meet that very someone. Now a quick word from our sponsor.
We've all seen, or even done, some things we wish we hadn't. Now, Fragments listeners can get a free month of Leafy, the new memory reprogramming app that teaches you how to replace traumatic images with happy ones. And now, try Leafy for kids. You can't promise them a brighter future, but you can give them a brighter past.
We're back, and joining us remotely is Dr. Peter Hammond, former professor of microbiology at Texas A&M University. Dr. Hammond, Daisy has brought me a bread wrapper with an unusual label above the ingredients. It reads, "Warning, not for consumption by individuals lacking the harvest microbiome modification. Consumption by unmodified individuals may result in injury or death." Is that familiar to you?
Very familiar, Dan. I wrote it.
Wow. Okay. So very familiar indeed. So what is the harvest? Can you explain what this is in terms our listeners and Daisy can understand? Is this what killed Hannah?
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. I need to back up a little. Have you heard of the microbiome?
Sure, yep. Gut bacteria, right? Like E. coli. Like the ones that help us digest food, but can also get out of whack and make us sick.
That's part of it, but it's much grander than that. Think of your whole body as an ecosystem, a gut river, a nose forest. On every single surface, diverse microorganisms have found places to live. Different environments, different lifestyles. And to make themselves welcome in those environments, some of these organisms do jobs that their hosts cannot. For instance, termites cannot digest wood without their gut bacteria. Deep sea squid can't glow in the dark without their tiny luminescent passengers. Now, most importantly for us, some microbes can even break down toxic chemicals for their hosts. Bacteria do this for insects all the time.
So does the bread contain microbes?
Oh, everything does, but not in the way that concerns us. Let me zoom out again. After secession, New Prosperity took on oversight of the public colleges in Texas. They had been running private schools for years, so it made sense. New Prosperity had a mandate to make schools both profitable and in alignment with Christian values as laid out in the new Constitution. Department heads like me faced a choice: either invent a goose to lay golden eggs or become a natural philosophy department spewing out papers to support doctrine as needed. That, or watch as we were defunded and unemployed. Now, I didn't see a problem with it at the time. Like most Texans, I was excited about independence, and I thought we'd be better off on our own. I had a Texit shirt just like everybody else. Of course, research should be profitable. I had a young family to support, and I thought I had just the golden egg to slam down in front of the auditors. Golden apple, that is.
I get the feeling we're talking about a literal apple.
I may have a taste for the dramatic. I chose something that would pack symbolic punch with the auditors. When they came to my lab, I showed them a cage containing two identical rats. I placed a tasty red apple in the cage, and both rats set to dining. One of them convulsed and dropped dead. "The harvest system, gentlemen," I said. "GM crops grown with artificially high levels of cyanide in their cells will be impervious to all pests, but edible to humans dosed with the harvest system microbes. You are looking at the end of pest-driven famine in our time."
Oh my God.
They said something similar. "At any rate, you may have noticed that pest-driven famine has not ended in our time."
Decidedly not. Dr. Hammond, let me see if I have this right. You genetically modify plants to produce cyanide to deter pests, then give humans cyanide-eating microbes so that they can still eat the plants?
Pretty much. Many plants produce small amounts of cyanide naturally. So it's actually a matter of removing the gene that restricts cyanide production, cutting the brake line. Then we make a mixture of cyanide-loving microbes. You need several species so they will colonize the entire digestive tract from tongue to... Well, you get it. They don't really prosper in humans, so people need to take monthly doses to remain immune to the poison. You can also give microbes to livestock so that they can eat high cyanide grains as well.
So what went so horribly wrong here?
Well, I assume New Prosperity would contact Monsanto or another big agricultural firm, and that although they would certainly monetize the harvest, it would eventually go on to benefit the world food supply. That is not what they did. They kept it. New Prosperity farms and ranches outcompeted all of their neighbors. Of course they did. And in order to get the microbe doses to make all of this bounty edible, you have to join New Prosperity Church with mandatory tithing and purchase a home in one of their gated communities.
So what did you do when you realized what was happening?
I made discreet inquiries as to why we weren't taking the technology public, and that put up red flags on my record. I confided in my wife, and we made an escape plan. I bought a beater car with cash and faked the registration docs. I knew they wouldn't willingly let me leave with what I knew. University admin asked us to move into a New Prosperity community. They waived all the fees and gave us a house, and I got the strong impression that it was to trade for my silence, not gratitude for my work. When we moved in, they held a big dinner in our honor, complete with the famous Pastor Prosper himself. It was my wife who started crying when the little angel collapsed. I knew it was now or never. After dinner that night, we put our exit strategy into play. Two big security men came to take us away, but I was ready. Some cone snail venom and micro-injectors lifted from my lab put them down quick and quiet. I donned the security uniform, dressed the guards in my clothes, and put the cuffs on my wife and children. They played dutiful prisoners in the back of the van, next to the unconscious father who resisted arrest. I nodded at the watchtower as we drove through the gates for the last time. We drove to an abandoned building a few towns away where I stashed the car and forged IDs for the border wall. We headed west.
Well, what's next? Are we going to see New Prosperity take over the continent farm by farm?
I wouldn't worry about that, Dan. As I said, I have a flair for the dramatic. I had one last research project stashed in a garage in Waco. Before we drove off into the night, I opened the lid on a crate containing 200 locusts, all endowed with the Harvest brand microbes. I thought of it as a Pandora's box before, but now I think I'll just call it Hannah's Revenge.
Our sponsor, Leafy, has reached out to give Daisy a free membership, but she declined. She's not looking to forget. She also declined an offer from Dr. Hammond and his family to join them. She says she still has some work to do. She wants to find out what happened to her parents. Dr. Hammond is setting up a lab somewhere and getting back to work. He still hopes his research, in the right hands, can feed the world. Good night, and thanks for listening to Fragments.
Hiding in the Hide by Gabriel Hart, with music by Fog Machine. Read by Gabriel Hart, Stephanie Tiza, and Jean-Paul Garnier.
Dr. James Wakin gazed out the window of his third-story office in downtown Los Angeles. For him, a rare moment of solitary introspection. As he looked down at the filthy streets of the homeless and the unruly stuck in perpetual transience, he thought,
"What happened to the cool, Jetson-esque mod world, the aesthetically sound future we were promised?"
James knew he did his part. The way he painstakingly furnished his office in mid-century modern meets contemporary cool, propelled by a couple key items of future brutalist flourish. His way of showing the evolution of timeless good taste in tandem with our collective aesthetic potential.
Good taste. That reminds me. Smells like the steak I'm cooking is about ready.
The ice clinked in his glass of scotch as he turned towards the kitchen, before being interrupted by a familiar movement to his right. James seized.
Stop licking the goddamn couch.
His hand swung like a sledgehammer on the arm of this white Monroe mid-century sofa, just missing the head of his bored to tears Jack Russell. The dog, who James called Young Pup, when he was in a more jovial show-off mood in front of guests or patients, had been mysteriously lapping up the same spot on his chalk-white Sauvage leather couch for what seemed like every living minute of their first month together. Luckily, with the reflex of a housefly, the mutt had bolted halfway across the carpet before James's unrelenting fist came down, so hard that he cursed again in the throes of dumb, self-inflicted pain.
God damn you, goddamn dog!
James screamed. Not completely bereft of conscience, he immediately felt foolish for yelling, so he cursed again out of embarrassment. No discipline would be achieved, only the dog's perplexity. Young Pup used to pine for James all day, hoping for a walk or the off chance they could curl up to watch TV. Anything that might make James calmly address him as Carl again, his proper name he was given upon rescue. Carl is what James called him when he was resigned to the moment. But now, he had run to the corner of the office to simply observe James freak out, his head tilted in both bewilderment and concern for his master. Every tantrum would end the same. James would take many a deep breath, trying to cool off. He realized a therapist like him should know better than to succumb to these constant near misses of animal abuse.
Good man. I sure do love that damn couch.
He would conclude, predictably contrarian. He weighed his options on the two objects, the couch and the dog, revealing ultimatum to which he could not object. The couch or the dog. James took out his cell phone, looking up the number for Wayward Waggers, the local animal rescue where he had picked up Carl the month prior. Deceptive with its pathetically cute name, Wayward Waggers was a kill shelter. Unbeknownst to James, this would be the fourth time problematic Carl would be returned to the pound. And needless to say, the last.
Hi there. I got a dog from you guys last month, and it's really just not working out. I'd like to begin the process of returning him, whatever it takes.
Okay, sir. You do realize this wasn't a fostering scenario.
Yeah, I know. Listen, just make this happen for me, okay?
All right, sir. You can go ahead and bring him in when we open at 10 a.m.
Great, thanks.
James curtly replied, relieved as well as annoyed.
To think that someone wouldn't do as I say the first time.
He thought. It wasn't just that he had spent a small fortune on that couch, special ordered from trendy West Elm. Carl's incessant licking of that particular area of the couch made James incredibly insecure, as his masterful compartmentalizing might threaten to unravel. He chose white, that particular shade of chalk white, to camouflage stains that may or may not have ended up there when many of his therapy sessions with the fairer species would inevitably blur into sudden dates, if the woman opened up enough and the stars and their horoscopes aligned to his specifications. But he wasn't licking those stains. He was licking the stain. His tongue a sacrament, not just to heal but to give a voice to the screaming cosmic life through the doorway of the dyed hide. And Carl, the Jack Russell, was trying to break through to the other side. The little guy even grew disinterested in walks after a while. James walked him twice a day, back when the novelty of a new puppy was still in its honeymoon stage. But the more Carl stayed in that live-in office, the more he became fixated on the cherished white sofa. James' eventual neglect for walkies might have looked especially cruel to some. James would put on his shoes by the front door, a Pavlovian signal that made Carl's tail wag in propeller-esque anticipation, only to be met by a door in his nose. But this is all Carl wanted. He actually just wanted James to leave already. The second that door shut, Carl would trot, trot, trot to the couch, leaping onto the far right cushion with great purpose. He would look back one more time to assure that that door was still closed, that James was well on his way to the bar downstairs. Knowing he would stay there for hours, Carl would turn his head to the sofa arm, tilting his head inquisitively. He would then lean in, sniff twice to make sure that that was still the spot that had accumulated his seasoning, before lovingly licking at the prized white leather. First up and down before tilting his head and really digging in there, putting ample pressure on the surface over and over, indenting and undenting the once immaculate upholstery that was beginning to wear away. Carl's ears perked up every time he would hear that sound from somewhere far away, in sync with each lick. It was the esoterically celebrated sound of the universe, the Om. It came to Carl in waves, as if the mystical symbol was on its own orbit, as Carl's licks would pick up its frequency in perfect time with it hitting its closest proximity to his acute senses, clearly tuned into a dimension far beyond the mass grave of our insatiable appetites. Like Morse code, Carl's lapping of his tongue created a wormhole of communication between the beyond and our mortal Earth, each lick giving every ohm its own characteristic, its own alphabet. That is, if you could feel a language instead of merely speaking it. After all, the universe didn't create words. Those are humans' exclusively remedial flashcards for our own dim wits. Carl felt it, all right. His tongue acted as a dowser to facilitate this unfolding phenomenon, his wagging tail now in perfect time with the rhythm of his hell-bent lick to the heavens, a metronome for the cosmos and the disembodied voices of the dead and the divine, the bovine. Stopping only occasionally to let out a concerned whimper from what the Om was trying to tell him, he would go right back into it, worried that he might break this vital chain of archaic transmissions. As he returned to his duty of drawn-out elusive seance, he stopped mid-lick, tongue curled against the treated skin of sacred cow, coincidentally, first worshipped in the same region that first recognized the Om as the sound of the universe. Now, with tongue stationary, making absolute and non-transitionary contact with the cell-rich membrane of a living thing's largest organ, the Om sustained. Carl lifted his tongue momentarily to see if it would cease, as the M punctuated his experiment. He returned his tongue to the surface, only this time it began where it left off.
Moo.
Countless miles into the heavens, hidden to the eye behind the veil of day, certain forgotten lines in our constellations began to flicker a little brighter. It was all happening light years behind the well-known Taurus. An assemblage of overlooked stars began to burn with such radiance, their light would finally reach our eyes on Earth, should anyone be paying attention. Shockingly defined and far less abstract than the bull, these group of stars outlined a perfect rendition of a cow, whose most important feature was its head downcast, in demoted shame, mourning the forgotten reverence of its species. Untold billions of individual bovine spirits had constructed this constellation, which set it apart from the other, mere earthly, interpretive formations. There was a magnetic pull from the hollow molecules of each spirit that fused it together with the nearest one, insentient yet instinctual, the way ants hold on to each other to create a larger raft-like flotation to avoid drowning. The poignancy of the cow's persecuted life, now worlds beyond the concept of sainthood, was applying faint but undeniable detail to the cow's form with the empathetic assistance of Carl's licks down below, like a paintbrush on canvas projecting its work into space. And then, with this divinely superimposed image complete, it hung silently in space until it began to multiply, like fanning a deck of cards by an all-knowing dealer who decided it was time for us to pay. Finally, after eons of earthly discordance, the circle was complete. Cracking the code, Carl had tuned into the frequency and the sequence of the true celestial voice, the cry of the cow as it came to be known. In the midst of the perpetual moo, Carl heard endless multitudes of animo moans, layer upon layer of mournful bellows and milk-curdling screams, heavy on the bottom end. It was the yearning, retroactive warning of the ages, the premonitory SOS happening in real time and in all time, since the first cow was sacrificed for humans' corrupt, lazy appetite of cowardice. What could be more antithesis to the life-affirming competition of the hunt than to kill a peaceful thing that just stands there in transcendent grace? It had since thrown our very creation off its axis, establishing war and, ironically, famine, bringing mutation to our cellular circuits, ensuring our doom would continue in such slow but steady drips, emulating the upside-down, gory last seconds of ritual throat slicing we would sadistically administer. Our pattern's nonsensical and selfish intent would radiate, ricochet off the stars and back again in karmic negatives, coagulating through our civilization stuck on a loop of self-destruction until the cow's guttural howls grew to such inhumane volume it would deafen us to any tangible window of redemptive opportunity. A sound that only certain gifted canines could hear. Call it persistence or call the pound, Carl got through. Suddenly, Carl heard keys jangling and sloppily penetrating the doorknob, and his master's voice outside, talking to a laughing woman he had picked up at the bar.
Oh, and just wait until you meet my sweet puppy. I mean, who rescued who, you know?
James had returned earlier than usual. Since he had reeled in his catch of the day, he decided to actually exhibit some discipline with just a couple late afternoon scotches with her downstairs. Unfortunately, the self-control would end at the front door as James zeroed into his canine's crime scene, the right side of his couch torn to shreds, springs protruding and cotton stuffing grounded like clouds shot out of the damn sky. James started screaming, but that's not what made Carl dart out the window onto the roof and onto the next one, and then onto the next. Dogs, clairvoyant beyond our wildest dreams, are also known to sense earthquakes minutes before they hit. Now that everything was a little loosened up, Carl decided he would rather have the freedom of uncertainty over the certainty of his master's bad company, as the 8.9 big one that was to come crashing at the end of James's happy hour would be perceived by Carl as the cow's final stampede. They were done crying.
On this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard The Harvest by Julie Carpenter, with music by the author, and Hiding in the Hide by Gabriel Hart, with music by Fog Machine. Theme music by Dane Lesko. Out now, Simultaneous Times, Volume 1, Paperback Science Fiction Anthology, available at spacecowboybooks.com and lulu.com. Be sure to visit us at our store in Joshua Tree, California, or at spacecowboybooks.com. And connect with us on Instagram or Twitter. We'd love to know what you think of the program. And now a word from other fellow Joshua Tree podcasters.
We live in a very weird place. A dry and mountainous land of poisonous creatures and desert monsters, missing tourists, and strange lights in the sky. Join us every Friday at 10 p.m. for a late-night voyage across the mysterious Mojave Wilderness on KCDZ 107.7.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Are you looking for a new way to think and transform? Tune into Myth Matters, a biweekly podcast of storytelling and conversation about mythology and why it's important to life today. Find a more creative way to live. Learn more at mythicmojo.com and keep the mystery in your life alive.
Have you ever wondered why people live in the desert? I'm Dawn Davis, and I host Desert Lady Diaries podcast. It's a weekly conversation with women who found their home in the Mojave Desert. Each week, I talk to women who were either born and raised in the desert or felt called to come here and what the desert means to them. You can learn more about the podcast and listen at DesertLadyDiaries.com.